Well, it's still morning, so good morning.
Welcome. On that clock, it's not.
No, that did throw me off. Welcome to our in-person arguments today. And I want to make one comment before we begin, and that's that when you do stand up, if you would help us with pronunciations, if there's an issue with your or your client's name, and also if there's any other information you'd like to provide about how we can refer to you and your client, go ahead and do that if you'd like. And we'll begin, I guess, if you're prepared, Mr. Phillips. All right, you may proceed.
Good morning, Tim Phillips on behalf of Appellant Lauren Peterson. May it please the court, counsel. Dismissal of appellant's malicious prosecution and negligence claims was improper. As this court stated in a case we just heard cited in the prior argument, Dunham v. Roer, 708 Northwest 2nd 552, a defendant is entitled to summary judgment as a matter of law only when the record reflects a complete lack of proof on an essential element of the plaintiff's claim. I'll briefly discuss both of appellant's claims, starting with her malicious prosecution claim. Respondent argued in its opening brief to the district court on summary judgment that, quote, prosecutorial immunity extends to Sergeant Christensen's statement in the complaint, unquote. Yet appellant did not sue respondent regarding Sergeant Christensen's statement in the complaint. Instead, respondent is liable for malicious prosecution because Sergeant Christensen requested criminal charges against her absent a reasonable belief that probable cause existed.
Mr. Phillips, can I interrupt you a moment?
Certainly.
A thought you said at the beginning, it raised a thought for me in terms of our review, and I appreciate that summary, the summary judgment standard, which we normally review de novo, but the point about the fact, since probable cause is kind of the intertwining element on the malicious prosecution and well, everything really, how do you review the record for an absence of a fact? In other words, normally we're looking at criminal matters and we look at these same facts and did the court, was the court correct that there's a probable cause or not? And there's a number of pieces to that, totality and objectiveness of the officer usually involved. So when you say we review if there's been any genuine issue of material fact, how do we look at your argument is an absence of a fact, meaning an absence. So aren't we really still in de novo looking at whether, similar to a criminal case, was there probable cause or not?
I would agree. Yes, I would agree with the court. Yes.
So all the facts or non-facts that exist are all there, even though it's a civil proceeding. It's just a matter of whether probable cause is present.
Correct.
Okay.
Minnesota applies the substantial factor test for causation. And this means the existence of more than one cause of harm does not necessarily lead to the conclusion that they are inconsistent or that they are not both substantial factors in bringing about the harm. So as the Minnesota Supreme Court stated in Osborne versus Twin Town Bowl, 749 Northwest 2nd 367, quote, if the causes are consistent and are both substantial factors in bringing about the result, they may both be a proximate cause of that result, unquote. In this case, Sergeant Christensen was not acting in a prosecutorial capacity when he requested criminal charges against appellant on August 27, 2020, nor when he replied to prosecuting attorney Claire Cole on September 17, 2020. And respondent did not argue otherwise in its opening summary judgment brief to the district court. Both of these acts on August 27th and September 17th, 2020, were substantial factors in bringing about the harm to appellant.
But weren't both, wasn't Sergeant Christensen's conduct on both occasions well within his discretionary duties as a police officer?
Correct, Your Honor. So there are two arguments that appellant is making on during this appeal, and with regard to malicious prosecution, appellant does agree that the conduct was discretionary with regard to the malicious prosecution claim. And then the question that arises is whether there was a fact issue for the jury on malice.
And what is the evidence of malice? not the fact issue so much as what is the actual evidence of malice here?
Right. Well, in this case, because Sergeant Christensen ignored the victim, Rebecca Brannon's identification of a different individual, the woman in the Pioneer Press photograph, even though Sergeant Christensen did not conclude that the woman in the Pioneer Press photograph was Lauren Peterson. And then, in addition to ignoring the victim's identification of the woman in the Pioneer Press photo as the perpetrator, Sergeant Christensen acted on the basis of a tip from someone, also not the victim, who even he did not conclude was reliable. And so there are fact questions for a jury, not about whether Sergeant Christensen believed that Lauren Peterson was the perpetrator, but about whether he had a reasonable belief that there was probable cause. There's a difference, of course, between having a hunch that this tipster is correct and having a reasonable belief that probable cause existed. A jury could conclude that Sergeant Christensen knew he did not have a reasonable belief. He had insufficient evidence to have a reasonable belief that probable cause existed, even though he at the same time had a hunch that this tipster was correct.
So that equates to malice in your mind?
It's a fact issue for the jury. It's not malice as a matter of law, but it creates a fact issue for the jury about whether he knew that he was acting beyond the scope of his lawful duties. So recognizing the fact that Sergeant Christensen's acts on August 27th and September 17th were substantial factors in bringing about the harm to appellant, respondent changed its position in its reply brief to the district court, stating that, quote, even if Christensen's initial investigation was negligent, his actions after the deferral were cleansed by prosecutorial immunity, unquote. This was a new argument raised for the first time in respondent's reply brief to the district court. Appellant was prejudiced by having to argue against a theory of the case that the district court allowed respondent to change significantly following the filing of appellant's response brief.
Do your statement of issues or the issues you've raised to this court, I don't think you're making a specific argument that the district court abused its discretion by letting the respondent make that argument and giving you a chance to reply and sir rebuttal. You're not specifically calling that out as an abuse of discretion, are you?
I believe that the briefing does call that out as an abuse of discretion, perhaps not using the exact language that the court is using, but that is certainly one of the issues on appeal, because this court must make it clear, and this is argued in the briefing, that new arguments in summary judgment reply briefs must be rejected pursuant to Minnesota General Rule of Practice 115.03C. And in the briefing, the case cited is the McGee versus Pottawatomie County 8th Circuit case 514 F3rd 739, in which... In which the 8th Circuit affirmed a district court's decision to not consider an argument raised for the first time in a summary judgment reply brief.
My question is whether we would need to get to that if we agreed with the respondent that the district court got the immunity part right, the official immunity. So if he's already afforded official immunity, then we don't have to get into this kind of procedural issue, because that only involves the prosecutorial, what you describe as a new issue. But we, going down the line, we wouldn't get to that point.
That would be
right.
The
district court got it right on the first one.
Yes, that would be correct.
Okay.
Yes.
And how are, let's say, call them elements of proof or components of official immunity different from prosecutorial immunity? What's the distinction?
So the distinction is, with regard to the malicious prosecution claim, official immunity asks whether there was malice or, you know, in other words, whether the officer knew that he was acting in a way that was unlawful, and that's a fact issue for the jury. The prosecutorial immunity question asks a different question, which is, was the conduct that the officer engaged in part of the initiation or maintenance of criminal charges? And so signing the statement in the complaint, for example, would be part of initiating the criminal charges, of course. But again, that's not the basis on which appellant sued a respondent in the first place. So even if this court were to consider the new argument raised by respondent with regard to prosecutorial immunity, as we're discussing here, that immunity only extends to initiation and maintenance of criminal charges. People can still bring claims against police officers when their conduct is a substantial factor in bringing about criminal charges absent a reasonable belief that probable cause existed. Absolute immunity is a total shield from liability, even when someone is not acting in good faith. So the mere fact that an officer subsequently signs a probable cause statement and a complaint cannot immunize all prior conduct related to the case. And in fact, the district court agreed with that proposition. Here, as we've discussed, Sergeant Christensen ignored the victim's identification of a different person and acted on the basis of a tip from someone who even he did not conclude was reliable. And so there are fact questions for a jury about whether Sergeant Christensen had reason to believe that his actions were prohibited, which is essentially the malice question. Of course, malice doesn't mean under the law that he intended to harm Ms. Peterson, but just whether he had reason to believe that his actions were prohibited.
If I could jump in just to make it clear on the official immunity to the negligence claim, it doesn't appear to me as I read your brief. Well, I'll put it in the positive. It looks to me like the only argument you make in your brief is that because this was ministerial, official immunity is not available. So if we disagreed with that and we determined that this was discretionary, it would appear to me that you're not making any argument in that sense, that you're sort of conceding that if it is discretionary, then official immunity does apply and protects against the negligence claim.
Correct, but the conduct is different with regard to each claim. So if the conduct of inquiring into a tipster's motivation is discretionary, then the court is correct that would defeat the appellant's argument as to the negligence claim. But as to the malicious prosecution claim, the question is whether there's a fact issue on malice for the jury.
And I do appreciate the distinction you're making in terms of what is the conduct specifically under which each claim is brought.
Right. And so although the respondent is relying on the declaration from Commander Jason Chase on the negligence claim, this declaration does not say or does not deny that the ministerial duty that would apply to an officer with regard to informants would also apply to anyone who's providing the same kind of information to officers. And even if this protocol is unwritten, there is a question and there is a reasonable inference at the summary judgment stage for appellant that this same ministerial duty to inquire, to at least inquire, not how to inquire, but to at least inquire into why an individual is making a tip or what basis the information that they're relaying, what is the basis for that.
Mr. Phillips, part of the argument that respondent makes is that you're conflating citizen tipster with what appears from that policy and reading the entire policy, confidential, reliable informants. And would you concede, at least on its face, there is a big distinction, meaning, number one, citizen tipsters are at least presumptively reliable, and of course then it's part of the investigation, whereas confidential, the concern of that policy is making sure that the confidential, reliable informant who probably is getting a benefit in some pending criminal charge or future charges, that's what that's really addressing, isn't it? And
the
how does that
evidence
play into our facts, knowing that that this tipster is not in that category of, how does that play in our review of the elements of the offense?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, and I will try to get through this in my last minute. So the evidence in the record is that the policy at issue applies to informants and not a tipster. But the question is whether it's a reasonable inference at the summary judgment stage that an officer, with regard to a tipster as well, would need to at least inquire regarding the basis for the tip. Not to say that an informant is the same as a tipster, and I agree with the court's discussion here, but just to say that it is a reasonable inference when you have a policy about informants that a similar duty, even if it's an unwritten protocol, would require an officer to inquire about the basis for a tip. And the reason is that otherwise it's, in essence, an anonymous tip. Although you may know the name of the person, if you haven't even asked how they know the individual who they're turning in, you have these kinds of results where the wrong person gets charged. I see that I'm out of time. I will be back on rebuttal. Thank you.
Go ahead whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Greg Sauter from the City of Minneapolis, and I'm here representing my client, the City of Minneapolis, as the city, and also standing in the shoes of decedent Sergeant Dean Christensen. I have an entire presentation put together here, but I'm going to address the last discussion that we just had about 10-203. And there is a fundamental distinction here, and plaintiff's counsel has actually stated why this is not a ministerial duty for Sergeant Christensen to go and searchingly look into the motivations of the tipster. Because a ministerial duty is one that is clear, specific, required. And counsel has made the argument, well, we can imply that this would apply. But that's not what ministerial duties are. They're duties that are clear and clear with four corners and well known. The case law on that is in the brief, but I think by saying this is an implied ministerial duty really concedes that it's not a ministerial duty, but rather one that is discretionary. The criminal justice systems in this case worked as it should have. An assault occurred. Sergeant Christensen gathered evidence and honestly believed that plaintiff was the suspect. Christensen's identification was reviewed by the prosecutor and questioned about it. Christensen looked at the evidence anew, recontacted the tipster, and confirmed his belief that the plaintiff was the suspect. The prosecutor then drafted charges, including a probable cause statement, and that statement itself was reviewed by a judge and signed. So at this point, we now have three different people determining that probable cause exists. When the mistake was identified and discovered, the charges were quickly dismissed, and the city did not object to its expungement. The district court did not err in granting summary judgment. Mr. Peterson has brought two claims against Sergeant Christensen and the city, both malicious prosecution and negligence. Both of those claims turn on Sergeant Christensen's duty to reasonably believe he had probable cause to believe that Ms. Peterson was the assaulting suspect. For malicious prosecution, the elements are an action brought without probable cause or a reasonable belief that the state would ultimately prevail on the merits. Two, malice, and three, terminated in favor of the suspect.
Why doesn't the sergeant's testimony that he had no reason to believe that the tipster was reliable or not, why didn't that language create a fact issue as to whether, in fact, he had a reasonable belief?
Well, one, he was honest, and he said he didn't. In that we have a set record, we have a decedent here who can't testify anymore, so that is the facts that we have. But more importantly here, the facts that were given him by Ms. Amore were all verifiable facts and self-verifying, and he did that kind of verification. He verified that she lived in St. Anthony. He verified that what she looked like by pulling up her driver's license. He looked at her Facebook page and made his own determination of similarity. The only fact that was there that Ms. Amore gave him that was not verifiable and is not true is that Ms. Peterson was the suspect in this case. So the facts that she gave, they themselves, he can rely on those facts to determine.
But Mr. Sauter, I think the question is, why isn't that statement enough for a reasonable jury to decide that his belief was unreasonable?
Your Honor, we're in a case where about a probable cause determination, and when there is no dispute in the record and there is the record is set, that is a judicial determination, not a jury.
What's the judicial determination?
Whether probable cause exists.
Right, but that's not the question. This isn't a criminal case. This is a civil case, and we're trying to decide summary judgment. So the real question is whether a reasonable juror could conclude that Christensen was unreasonable in his belief. It's not whether a judge would sign the complaint, right? It's whether a reasonable juror could conclude that Christensen was unreasonable. And if they can, then perhaps there's a civil claim here. So I go back to the question that Judge Bjorkman asked, which is, why isn't that statement by itself enough for a reasonable juror to make the conclusion that Christensen was unreasonable in his belief?
Your Honor, when one looks at the evidence in the record, it's defendant's contention that all the facts put together, because probable cause is a totality of the evidence received by the investigator. And that fact does not go and soil the rest of his determination, because he had those facts. And that one fact does not change the totality of the evidence, which points as Ms. Peterson as the suspect here. Granted, she is not the she is not the person who did this, and nor is there any contention that she had anything to do with this. And the law creates a system where police officers aren't required to be perfect. The law police officers are required to investigate the crimes and then present charges. And in this case, he was doing his job, what he reasonably is required to do. And
again,
in this,
I think the system you're referring to is the criminal justice system. But that's not this case. This is a civil case. So there can be probable cause to sign a complaint that can still give rise to a civil action, right?
But, Your Honor, if there is probable cause, then there is no civil action. And this was reviewed by the prosecutor. This was reviewed by the judge.
Let me give you a fact pattern, okay? Let's say Christensen found out that that's not the person, knew that this is not the same person, and kept that fact hidden, put in the affidavit signed by a judge. The judge's signature doesn't make Christensen's conduct something that can avoid a civil action.
Your Honor, there is nothing in the record that shows that kind of malice.
No, I understand that. That's not my question. My question is simply, when you're talking about the system that we have here, again, you're arguing about the criminal justice system. In our cases, it doesn't matter whether the judge signed this complaint or not. We're trying to determine at the summary judgment stage whether a reasonable juror could have concluded that Officer Christensen was not malicious, or could conclude that Officer Christensen was malicious, or could conclude that Officer Christensen was negligent or not. And I don't see why the judge's determination of probable cause is relevant to the question at hand.
Your Honor, it and all the determinations along the way show what is reasonable.
Well, I mean, I guess I could see you arguing to us that we should agree with the signing judge, right? And that's slightly different, but I don't see the fact that a judge said there's probable cause. I'm not sure I understand the relevance of that.
Your Honor, I think we can agree to disagree on that fact pattern.
What did the district court do? Did the district court determine there is probable cause, or did the district court determine a reasonable juror could find probable cause? Or a reasonable juror could say that Christensen was reasonable to think there was probable cause, to put it exactly correctly?
Your Honor, I would need to look at the opinion one more time, and I believe it said, but I defer to the opinion, that there was probable, the court found there was probable cause, Your Honor. But I would defer to the court's opinion on that.
But let me, one more follow-up for you, because I do agree, in my reading of the district court's order, the district court did not, I don't know if the district court asked this right question, but it appeared to me that the district court was making more of a determination of probable cause, probably because we're accustomed to doing that as judges, right? Do you see in appellant's brief any argument that the district court failed to apply the proper summary judgment standard?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
But the point is, we've created a system where people are allowed to make mistakes. It's reviewed again, and it's reviewed again. But we don't have a criminal justice system that assumes every time that probable cause is found wanting after that initial stage that somehow it's a malicious act that leads to tort liability. And that's what plaintiff is trying to do here, is create that. The system worked here. The failures were identified. I'd like to direct the court's attention to the analysis of official immunity. And the official immunity analysis doesn't really change whether one is looking at the negligence claim or the claim of malicious prosecution. The first question the court must ask is the activity that is challenged a discretionary act or a ministerial act? And then determine whether or not there's malice. Even though malice doesn't exist in negligence, for official immunity it does. For a government actor acting and doing their discretionary duties, malice does account. And malice, the city freely agrees that malice is the knowing doing that which is unlawful, not an intent to hurt or otherwise ruin somebody for untoward purposes. And in this case, all of the acts that are challenged here, and the two specific acts are not going into a searching identification of the biases of Ms. Amore, and the second one is not identifying the woman in the Pioneer Press photo that the victim identified as said, that's her. None of those acts and none of those decisions in the investigation, plaintiff has pointed to no bit of law or policy that requires either of those acts be done. And it really gets back into the very very issue and why this is a discretionary act of what Christensen was doing in his investigation. He was gathering evidence. He was choosing which leads to follow, which leads to not follow, and making his determination. It's undisputed that an assault occurred. It's undisputed that somebody who looks a lot like plaintiff, not the same person, committed that assault. And it's undisputed that when he opened the investigation, Sergeant Christensen received word from Ms. Brannon and also her tipster that this must be Ms. Peterson. All of those things are undisputed, and how he takes that evidence, what he puts together, and what he does with that is up to him. The difference between the confidential reliable informant and Ms. Amore as a citizen tipster is substantial, and that's why we have specific rules for citizen CRIs and other informants. Whether the facts that he received from Ms. Amore were those facts that were facts that were verifiable, and he verified most of them. So, and then with regard to the Pioneer Press article, he didn't make a determination either way that was the suspect here, but he didn't need to because he had other evidence that tied her to the crime. Whether he pursues that lead, whether he contacts the Pioneer Press and asks them, hey, who's in the photo? Whether the Pioneer Press has the information of who's in their photos or even would want to cooperate with the police. There's nothing in the record that shows that determines that. We just don't know who's in the photo, and we know he didn't make that phone call, but we don't know anything else there. It could have turned into nothing. It could have turned into something. And this is the challenge with what officers and investigators are doing. They're investigating a crime and gathering evidence and determining whether or not they believe probable cause exists. Now, with regard to the alleged new argument, the city has not admitted to new argument, but addressing that issue directly, The district court has discretionary authority whether or not to consider that argument. And that is reviewed on an abuse of discretion standard, and the issue is whether or not there is prejudice. Plaintiff had an opportunity to respond to this orally at hearing and also submitted a SIR reply brief. Any prejudice that plaintiff may have received from that argument has been obviated by that.
So I know you don't have much time left, but you're not conceding that this was a new argument. Is that because you don't make a distinction between official and prosecutorial immunity, or is that because you think there was something about the opening brief that was enough to establish prosecutorial immunity, or some other reason?
There was something about, there's an absolute distinction between the two. And there was, and the case referred to and the governing case in that was referred to and spoken about in the brief. Plaintiff is correct, stating that it talked about one part of the timeline, and I talked about that part of the timeline and an earlier part of the timeline later, Your Honor. And I see that I am out of time.
Well, I didn't mean to rob you of your last sentence here, so if you want to wrap up, feel free.
Your Honor, Sergeant Christensen was doing the best job he could. And the state, when it recognized its error, it corrected it. This is not the land of tort. This shouldn't sit in the land of tort. It should be, we ask that the court affirm the district court and find that probable cause existed and affirm the dismissal, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Rebecca Brannon, the victim, did not say at any point that Lauren Peterson, the appellant, was the perpetrator. What she said was, clearly it's her in that Pioneer Press photo, and separately I got a tip from this other person who says it's Lauren Peterson. The fact that Sergeant Christensen admits that he did not know or determine or inquire about whether this tipster was reliable or not, he didn't determine, conclude that she was reliable or not, that does create a dispute of fact for a jury
When you say that he didn't confirm her reliability, I mean, he did do some things. I mean, he figured out that, in fact, Ms. Peterson did live in St. Anthony and confirmed the name and looked at photos that he thought were close, you know, that there was a close resemblance there. So isn't there the claim being made as he didn't do enough to assess her reliability?
He admitted that he did not determine whether she was reliable. Now, it's true, Judge, that he did some work on the case, and you know, appellant doesn't dispute that. But the question is, when he failed to make a determination about whether she's reliable and admitted that, you know, under oath in his deposition, does that create a fact issue for the jury about whether he needed to do more to have a reasonable belief in probable cause? Now, of course, he can look at photographs and have a hunch that this tipster is right, but he knew what the standard was.
Is the argument that he had a duty to assess the tipster's reliability in addition to any duty he might have had to assess the reliability of the information provided? In other words, making a distinction between the person and the information, because there are lots of facts that show he tried to determine whether the information was correct, and in that sense, reliable, right? It seems like you're also saying, separate from that, he needed to have assessed this person's reliability.
Under State versus Cook, he did need to verify that the information obtained from this person showed a basis of knowledge. And really the question is, how could he reach the level that he knew was required of probable cause to initiate a criminal charge? And maybe that's a combination. Maybe that's a mix from those two boxes that the court's talking about. But he can't have reached that determination, which he knew was the level, the probable cause level, to initiate criminal charges. He cannot have reached that determination when he admits in his own deposition testimony not only the statement about reliability, but he admits, basically, for all I knew, this person could have been some alt-right person who went online, they found a Black Lives Matter protester, they found that they looked similar to the person in the video, and they told me it was them. That's, for all I know, that's what happened, is what he said during his deposition testimony. And that's just not, that can't be the standard. And the reason is, in this day and age with the internet, it's really not that complicated for someone to find someone on Facebook and then tell you, I can tell you where they went to school. I can tell you where, what city they live in. That's not really sufficient to, when you haven't determined that the tipster is reliable, that information alone is not sufficient. Now, if he had inquired.
I assume an identified tipster is reliable?
No, I mean, he didn't. I mean, even in his own deposition.
He verified the information to the extent he could, but I mean, part of it is, yeah, there is a presumption that people who come out of the woodwork, if you will, members of the public that come up and are willing to be identified? Isn't there some
In sense? This case, that may be true, but in this case, he had information such as her bias against anti-police protesters. He had a reason to question whether she was reliable, and he admitted during his deposition that in this case, he did not conclude that she was reliable. And there's a question for the jury. This is not...
Right, well, let me follow up, because I think the question for the jury, for me, I know you're running out of time, but I want to make sure I ask this question of you. In your mind, is there a difference between whether there's probable cause and whether Officer Christensen was reasonable in his belief that there was probable cause?
There's certainly a difference there.
And we already say probable cause is a low standard.
Correct.
So if there's a difference, you agree that the belief that there's probable cause would even be lower than probable cause? In other words, we would be saying, is it reasonable to have a belief that there's reasonable suspicion if, in fact, this were a reasonable suspicion instead of probable cause? So it's necessarily lower than probable cause.
I would agree that it is lower. It's similar to the 1983 context with arguable probable cause. It's similar did he have a reasonable belief that there was probable cause? But that doesn't change whether this is a fact issue for the jury. Thank you. I'm out of time.
Are there any other questions?
No,
okay.
Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you both for your arguments today and the written arguments. I appreciate them very much. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory time frame. Have a great day.